Well, good morning. It is good to be back. We were on a 10th anniversary trip last Sunday, and it's not very often that one of us aren't at least in church. And it felt really strange to not know that there was church going on and we weren't here. We did actually go to church, and it wasn't St. Mattress. So we got to experience something new, and it was good. It was very different from how we do church. For one thing, the music or the singing was almost non-existent. Like, it was beautiful in that they had an organ, a big, huge organ, but the singing was basically a couple kind of just singing with the organ, and there were a few hymns that we sang together as a group, but you could barely hear people. It just wasn't something they did, I guess, was singing together. So it made me appreciate how much we're involved in singing as a congregation and not just the person leading it. Anyway, good to be back. And it's also good to see Monroe's again. I know they were here last Sunday, but we didn't get to see him, so good to see you back. As probably most of you know, we're on a bit of a journey with the story of the children of Israel leaving Egypt and on their way to the Promised Land. And I guess the series is called The Story. And I think I mistitled my message here. I think this is actually from last time. So I think we're on part 26. This says 25, but I think that was from last time. Anyway, last time we looked at the story of the tribes of Reuben and Gad wanting to stay on the other side of the Jordan River in the land of Gilead instead of going into Canaan like God had asked them to do. And we looked at how that was not God's plan and how that it ended up leading to some pretty sad consequences for those tribes. But more importantly, we looked at how and why this story is there. And I had completely missed it before digging into it. But we saw that it was a repeat of the story of Adam and Eve. It's a reminder that we are often not content with what God gives us and think we have a better plan, and then go with that plan, and that ends up leading to some pretty sad things. And in this case, with the tribes of Reuben and Gad, God allows them to do that, but going their own route ends up leading to them getting hauled off and becoming slaves to another nation because they weren't under the protection of God inside the land of Canaan. But last time I said that we're probably going to get to the actual crossing of the River Jordan, and so you're probably all wondering if that's going to happen. Well, as is the case often when you start digging into something, you find more things. And so, no, we're not actually going to get over Jordan yet, just to take the tension away there. We're actually going to stay in the very last chapter of Deuteronomy and then actually move into Joshua, but not all the way across the Jordan yet. So if you want to turn to Deuteronomy chapter 34, just have that ready. We're going to look at this account for a bit, but before we do that, I'd like to show you some pictures. Trenton, if you want to put up the first set there of a place that is pretty astounding. You want to put up the first set? Any of you know where this is or what this is? Any of you know what country it's in? We'll start there. I didn't either. It is in Saudi Arabia, Medina or Medina. It is called the Green Dome or the Prophet's Mosque. And the whole complex is one of the largest buildings in the world. If you go back to the very first picture, just show that again. It was built originally by the Prophet Muhammad, but in 1985, they did a major upgrade expansion to it, And it was finished, like that part of it was finished in 1992. And at that point, it was 1,700,000 square feet and could fit 1 million worshipers in there. And then in 2012, they started an expansion project. And it's still underway, but it's going to double the number of people it can hold. I'm not sure if it's going to double the actual size, but it's going to fit, be able to fit 2 million worshipers. And one of the main attractions there is actually that green dome. If you flip forward to, so under that green dome is actually where, supposedly where the grave of Muhammad is, which is part of the attraction there. It's not considered one of the main points that you go to on like the pilgrimages that Muslims are supposed to go on. But according to what's written in, from what I read, they say that 1,000 other prayers are equal to one prayer prayed in that mosque. So it's a pretty large attraction. But again, the tomb there, I think there's some pictures there of the actual tomb toward the end maybe. Yeah, that it's not a great picture, but it was kind of hard to find good ones because I doubt they actually allow photography there. But behind all that gold and stuff is supposed to be the burial place. And then I have another set of pictures in memorial of someone else. I'm going to flip to the next one. This is called the Joseph Smith Memorial Building. And if you know who Joseph Smith was, he was the founder of the Mormon movement. You flip through some of those. Not nearly as grand of a building, but still a very beautiful, pretty majestic looking place. Done in memorial of Joseph Smith, and there's a statue of him, I think, somewhere there in the building. Anyway, I show you these because, well, just keep those pictures in mind. Yeah, there it is. As we read this next part here, we're going to start in verse 5 of Deuteronomy 34, and then we'll explain why I showed you those. So Deuteronomy 34, verse 5, it says, "So Moses, the servant of the Lord, died there in the land of Moab, according to the word of the Lord, and he buried him in the valley in the land of Moab opposite Beth Peor. But no one knows the place of his burial to this day. Moses was 120 years old when he died. His eye was undimmed and his vigor unabated. And the people of Israel wept for Moses in the plains of Moab 30 days. Then the days of weeping and mourning for Moses were ended." I'm going to stop there for now. You get why I showed you those pictures. There is a tendency among people to worship leaders after they're dead. And there's a tendency of people to worship things that aren't even great. Especially we saw the children of Israel, they were willing to worship something that they just made on the spot, a gold calf, and say that that was what brought them out of Egypt. And God did some absolutely amazing things. I would say God probably worked through Moses more than any other person up to that point in history. I mean, look at the number of miracles that were performed through Moses, and just amazing stuff that we've looked at already. And God has some incredible things to say about Moses. He calls him his servant. If you look at verse 6 there, I think it is. No, I guess verse 5. "So Moses, the servant of the Lord, died." And there's other places where that same phrase is used. And that's an incredible compliment, that God would specifically say that somebody is his servant. But I think there's a reason God chose to take Moses the way he did and then buried him in a place that no one has found. And it's interesting that it specifically mentions that. And so that's why I wanted to just look at that a little bit. And I think it's an indication of just how quickly we are as people to worship other people, and including dead ones. God knew that the hearts of the people, and especially the hearts of the Israelites, would worship things that weren't alive and hadn't done anything, but how much more would they have eventually built memorials and maybe even done pilgrimages to that place if they would have known where Moses had died. And I think it's, like I said, it's just a good reminder that no matter how powerfully God uses a person should never be the focus of our adoration or worship. And that's as much idolatry as bowing down to an idol. It's like a physical idol. And I think that's maybe why that was specifically mentioned there, that God buried him in a place that no one has found yet. There was actually an account. I should have put down the details in my notes, but I didn't. But I was reading a story of one of the Roman emperors actually decided to send a whole army over to this area and try to actually find the burial place of Moses. And you know, they looked at what was written in the Old Testament here, and supposedly one group said, "Well, it has to be here." Like, they found a place that they thought matched everything. Then there was another group from the same army that said, "No, it has to be up here." And so there was kind of this debate back and forth, and they never came to a conclusion on it. So as far as we know, it's still never been really determined whatsoever where that actually is. Anyway, that brings us to the part that we're going to spend the most time on this morning, and that is the new stage of this saga, the part with a new leader, and the part where the promises of God come true. This is one of the main promises that God had given to Abraham right way back from the beginning, and we've looked at all that, and finally this all comes true. But we're going to specifically look at the character of Joshua. And this is a guy that I have never really, I guess, dug into as far as who he was and why God chose him. So I'd like to just spend the rest of our time looking at that. I'm going to read the rest of the end of Deuteronomy here and then into the first three verses of Joshua. So 34, verse 9, "And Joshua the son of Nun was full of the spirit of wisdom, for Moses had laid his hands on him. So the people of Israel obeyed him and did as the Lord had commanded Moses." I just had to think about, we looked at the laying on of the hands of the deacons this morning. That was significant. That was started all the way back here, and it's interesting that it specifically mentions that Moses laid his hands on him, and they were still doing that in the early church. Verse 10, "And there has not arisen a prophet since in Israel like Moses, whom the Lord knew face to face, none like him for all the signs and wonders that the Lord sent him to do in the land of Egypt, to Pharaoh and to all his servants and to all his land, and for all the mighty power and all the great deeds of terror that Moses did in the sight of Israel." So again, just a reminder of how powerfully God used Moses, and God specifically mentions that. And then moving on into Joshua, chapter 1, "And the death of Moses, after the death of Moses, the servant of the Lord said to Joshua the son of Nun, Moses' assistant, 'Moses, my servant, is dead. Now therefore arise, go over this Jordan, you and all this people, into the land that I am giving them to the people of Israel.'" "Into the land that I am giving to them, to the people of Israel. 'Every place that the sole of your foot will tread upon, I have given you, just as I promised to Moses.'" Like I said, I had never really dug into the character of Joshua. In some ways, he just feels like, well, I guess he just has to kind of take on where Moses left off. And I never really realized how significant of a character he is, and how much deeper the character of Joshua is. And so that's what we're going to try to dig into quickly here. The first time we see Joshua in the Bible is actually back in Exodus 17, verse 9. And I'm just going to quickly turn to that, read a couple verses there. This would have been right after the people left Egypt. They would have just crossed the Red Sea. So Exodus 17, verse 8 says, "Then Amalek came and fought with Israel at Rephidim. So Moses said to Joshua, 'Choose for us men and go out to fight with Amalek.'" So Moses chooses Joshua. And this, like I said, this is the first time he's mentioned. I was going to read down through 13, but I think for sake of time, I think we know the story there. We looked at it earlier, the story of Joshua takes men and goes out to fight with the Amalekites, and Moses lifts up his hands, and then Aaron and what was the other guy, Hur, held up Moses' hands. And the point there was that the battle was the Lord's. It was up to God to win that battle for them. But it specifically mentions that Joshua was the general chosen to go lead that. From what we can tell, he probably would have been around 30 years old at that point. And Joshua, from what we can tell in further accounts, he was kind of became the assistant to Moses. He was kind of with him through everything that Moses was doing. And he doesn't come up very often, but there are other accounts, specifically Mount Sinai, where the Ten Commandments are given. Yeah, if we look at, what is the verses there? It's when he comes, when it says that Moses came back down from the mountain, it specifically says that Joshua goes down with him, and Joshua is the first one to hear that the Israelites were partying with the whole golden calf thing. And so either Joshua did go up with Moses. It doesn't say, I would tend to think that he didn't necessarily go up the mountain, but he must have been at least waiting at the bottom of the mountain because he comes into the camp with Moses. So that would have been a pretty huge honor to be able to at least go to the edge of the mountain because nobody else was allowed to come close to it during that time. So he would have been very, very closely involved with all the work that Moses would have been doing. He would have seen everything that happened from leaving Egypt and the whole story. But I think the most notable story that we would know of Joshua is the 10 spies that go into Canaan to have a look around. And this would have been before the whole thing where the Israelites had to go wander around in the wilderness for 40 years. And it's interesting because actually at that point and earlier, before that account, Joshua's name was actually Hosea. Our English translations don't specify that, but the Hebrew was a different spelling. And I think it's probably done for sake of clarity. If they had named him Hosea and then now it's Joshua, we wouldn't have known that we're talking about the same person here. So they just used Joshua through the whole time. But Hosea, his earlier name would have meant save or saves in Hebrew. But during that the account of where Joshua goes in with the 10 spies and then it was him and one other guy were the only ones that believed that they could go take the land like God had promised. It's during that time that Moses actually changes his name to Joshua, and that means God saves. So it's like adding God to the front of that. It wasn't just saves or salvation. It was now God saves or Jehovah is salvation is another way to interpret it. And aside from the meaning, there's something else really significant about Joshua's name. And this is the part that just kind of blew me away. Obviously, at this point, the Israelites were using Hebrew as their language. And the books of the Old Testament written during this time would have been in Hebrew. However, when Jesus came, the Jews were living under a very Greek influence, a time when it was the language they would have used would have been Greek. There was still, I guess, Aramaic used. I'm not an expert on the languages, but the New Testament is written in Greek that we would translate from. Anyway, if you take the name Joshua and translate it into Greek, it's translated Jesus. It kind of blew my mind. I was like, this can't quite be right. I read it in a commentary, so I started looking and checked all the different sources I could find, and they all said the same thing. Joshua translated into Greek is Jesus. And obviously, Jesus was a Greek name. If you go back and try to take Jesus back into Hebrew, then it's translated as Joshua. And like that is too big of a coincidence to just they're not, like, God would have known that that's how it was going to get translated into Greek. So there's got to be something here that's deeper than just a coincidence. And there definitely is. Something we see in the Old Testament over and over is how the original story of the Garden of Eden is repeated. We looked at that last time, actually, with that story of the tribes wanting to stay where they were in Gilead there. But in the story of Eden, we see that God creates a garden with animals, and he then creates a man to oversee and govern those animals. And the breath or the spirit of God was what brought Adam to life and filled him and gave him the ability to do that task that God gave him, which was to oversee the animals. And now this took me a little bit to wrap my mind around, but it's really interesting. The same phrase referring to God breathing his spirit into Adam is basically the same Hebrew phrase that's used to describe what was given to Joshua. So that breath of God, that spirit that was breathed into Adam, that same term is used to describe what God did to Joshua. If you want to turn to Numbers 27, verse 15, well, you don't have to turn to it. I'll just read a couple of verses here. This is kind of the language that's used. Oops. I don't think it's... Is that the right verse? 27. Yes, yeah. So Numbers 27, verse 15. Moses spoke to the people, saying, "Let the Lord, the God of the spirits of all flesh, appoint a man over the congregation who shall go out before them and come in before them, who shall lead them out and bring them in, that the congregation of the Lord may be not as sheep that have no shepherd." So the Lord said to Moses, "Take Joshua the son of Nun, a man in whom is the Spirit, and lay your hand on him, make him stand before Eleazar the priest and all the congregation, and you shall commission him in their sight." So that beginning earlier in that part, that phrase, "in whom is the Spirit of life," that's the same thing that's referred to as far as what God gave Adam. And then there's kind of an idea of a further breath or spirit being put into Joshua from Moses. So that is kind of passed on to him. But then what really was interesting to me is that the what comes next, where Moses specifically says they are like sheep that don't have a shepherd. Again, this would have completely, I wouldn't have caught this without digging into it deeper, but it's the same idea of what Adam was supposed to do to the animals. They were supposed to have a caretaker. And Moses is pointing back to that account in Genesis and saying, these people are just like those animals. They're not going to have a caretaker. God, you need to appoint someone to take care of them. And so Joshua was supposed to be another version of Adam, is what the point is that we're supposed to get there. He was supposed to be taking care of those animals, and it wasn't just the task that anyone could do. It had to be someone that was appointed by God. And it was made very clear when Moses asked God to appoint a successor. It wasn't just that Moses went and picked somebody that he thought would do good at this. He went to God specifically and asked him asked him to appoint him. And so God right away does that. There was no waiting around, or at least from what we can tell from the account there. So Joshua was supposed to be another Adam. And obviously we know what happens with the first Adam. He immediately fails at his task. I'd like to read, I don't know if we have time to read all of what I was planning on here. I was going to read verses 1 through 9 again in Joshua, but maybe for sake of time, we've kind of already looked at some of this, but if you want to jump to verse 5, It says, no man shall be able to stand before you all the days of your life. This is God speaking to Joshua. Just as I was with Moses, so I will be with you. I will not leave you or forsake you. Be strong and courageous, for you shall cause this people to inherit the land that I swore to your fathers to give them. Only be strong and very courageous, being careful to do everything to all the law that Moses, my servant, commanded you. Do not turn away from it to the right hand or to the left, that you may have good success wherever you go. Now, the reason I specifically wanted to mention that, God gave Adam and Eve a specific law, and it was a very simple one thing, do not eat from the tree. And it's interesting that he specifically mentions that here again to Joshua, keep my law. And it's the same pattern that he used with Adam. He first breathes into him, gives him the spirit, gives him a task, which is to take care of the people, which are compared to the animals, and then follow my law. And in this case, it's a much, much more complicated law. There's much more to it than just the one that was given to Adam. But verse 8 says, this book of the law shall not depart from your mouth, but you shall meditate on it day and night, so that you may be careful to do everything to all that is written in it. For then you will make your way prosperous, and then you will have good success. Also, we looked at this last time too. Canaan was supposed to be a representative of Eden again. It was an opportunity to start over with God living among his people and basically returning to what Eden was supposed to be. Now, obviously, there was sin, but it was supposed to be another attempt at what was lost in Eden, and that God had chosen these people out, and then he was taking them to a specific place where he was going to dwell with them. And that had not been the case up until that point after being kicked out of the garden. So again, just another reason to look at this as Joshua being another version of Adam. We really looked at the importance of keeping the law. But what is really interesting to me was the fact that Joshua was faithful. Normally you start out a story like this and you're like, yeah, but he's gonna mess it up. You know, he's gonna get so far in then he's gonna rebel. He's gonna do something. You know, Moses did it. But you know, Adam did it first, and then every other time where that was the case, the leader ends up falling. But that's not really what we see with Joshua. There is a time where he kind of gets tricked into doing something because he doesn't consult with God first, but there's never a time where he rebels against God or specifically goes against the will of God. In fact, his last words when he's dying, it's at the end of Joshua, are just amazing. I mean, it's the part of choose you this day who you will serve. That was his dying speech to the Israelites. But he was faithful through his whole life. I love the very ending of his speech. The choose you this day is kind of the beginning of it, but the ending to it is, then put away the foreign gods that are among you and incline your heart to the Lord, the God of Israel. Just an amazing thing to leave with the people that he was shepherding, that he was supposed to be in charge of or leading. Like I said, Joshua was not perfect, but there are no accounts of him falling away or specifically rebelling against God. So in a sense, he was a better Adam, and yet he wasn't the fulfillment of what Adam was supposed to be. And that's where it really is amazing, this whole account of Joshua and who he was. It's the fact that Joshua points forward to another, even better Adam, and that better Adam is Jesus. And I think that's why that's not a coincidence that his name translated into Greek is Jesus. There's a couple very interesting correlations between Jesus and Joshua. First of all, both of them were single, as far as we know. There's no account of Joshua ever getting married, like Jesus. And both were faithful their life. Joshua was not sinless, obviously, because he was human, but there's no accounts of him falling away like we already looked at. And they were both faithful to God and fulfilled their callings as shepherds of the people that they were in charge of. Joshua led the people of Canaan, of the people of Israel, into Canaan, which was their promised land, kind of their Eden. And just like Jesus has made a way for us to go to our promised land, which is heaven. Joshua, the first thing we see that he does is deliver God's people from their enemies, the Amalekites. And Jesus also delivered us from our ultimate enemy, which is Satan and the power of sin. Now, Joshua couldn't release the people that he was in charge of from the power of sin, but it's a type, it's a pointing forward to what Jesus would do. Jesus was able to break that power of sin and death permanently, and not just while he was living on earth. And that's the interesting thing about Joshua. He was able to keep the, for the most part, keep the people of Israel faithful while he lived and while he was overseeing them. But it wasn't long after he was gone that they forgot what he said, and they did walk away. And that power of sin was still a part of their lives. And they fell right back into idol worship and all the things that went with that. And yet, here we are, 2,000 years after, more than 2,000 years after Jesus, and they're still a faithful church. Not that we don't fall, but the work of what Jesus did break that curse of sin in our lives to the point that we have been, or there has been, a faithful group for all this time. And that's never been the case before with all the other leaders that God put in charge of his people, the Israelites. At some point, they always completely fell away and had to be judged and brought back. And yet, there's always been a faithful group ever since Jesus did what he did. So I wish I had a bunch more of, like, I guess, personal application for this account. I don't necessarily, aside from just maybe another reminder that everything in Scripture is pointing forward to what Jesus did. And everything is connected to that. And so as we read the Old Testament and these characters, these leaders, these stories, it's just another reminder of how it all points forward to one thing, and that's the character of Jesus, the person of Jesus. And also just a reminder, I guess, of how strong that grip of sin is and how that has to be broken and how Jesus had to do that for us. Next time, just maybe we shouldn't even go there, but there is another account here that I think we have to dig into, and that's the story of Rahab. So I guess I probably jumped a little too quickly in saying that we will get over Jordan, but I think we're going to look at that one next time. If you want to dig into that a little bit yourself, I'd love to see what you come up with. Also a very interesting story. Considering everything that we've been looking at so far, it kind of changes the perspective a little bit. And just think about how that points forward to what Jesus did. There's definitely connections there. So look forward to that next time. Thank you.